I come from the Marcus Autism Center, which is one of the largest centers of clinical care for children and families impacted by autism in the country. And we're also a center of science, of training, and advocacy. And most of the resources of our center are devoted to addressing the needs of children and families today. But Warren and I decided to talk about infants and toddlers today. And the reason for that is that we really feel that collectively we are at a crossroads. Our science has truly advanced to the level that it makes it a true bioethical imperative to address the major issue of our time, which is how to advance early detection, universal screening, early detection, early diagnosis, so that we can improve access to services, with the notion that those early treatments can truly change developmental trajectories with lifetime consequences. In the United States, there are 60,000 children who are born every year who will have autism. Therefore, we have a huge public health issue, and our goal was to try and capitalize on the new developmental social neuroscience to meet those big public health challenges. But everything that we do begins here. In fact, this little girl is a 15-month-older with autism, and she has been truly the inspiration for most of what we're going to present to you today.
You're glad to step you.
As a clinician, we are just walking laboratories of social engagement. We are resonating this child. I'm 2 inches from her eyes, and she is totally ignoring me, so she can't see me. 5 minutes later, she does this.
Haley, up. Haley, up.
So she couldn't see me 2 inches from her eyes, but she could see an M&M about 5 feet away. So you imagine that this world is a very complex world with sounds and with a whole bunch of visual stimuli. But the fact is that the world does not have this flat landscape of salience. Some things are more important than others. But for this little girl, it was truly an object and not the person on the outside. So most of what we've been doing is trying to understand this little girl's mind. I really sort of had to ask myself, what is she seeing and what is she thinking? And how are those experiences influencing her brain development? And so we had to sort of resort to some experiments. Of course, we are clinicians who want to elevate our clinical feelings to the level of science so that we can quantify it and study it. And so this is a classic method in neuroscience, and I wonder what you're seeing as I'm playing this animation. Well, I think you've seen it. These are point light displays that are basically displaying something called biological motion, which is the motion of living beings. Babies come into this world with an innate preferential orientation to those movements, almost like a life detector. And this is a highly conserved mechanism of socialization that you see in primates, and you see in dolphins, you see in cats, you see actually in newly hatched chicks. It's part of the imprinting mechanism. And so we created an experiment in which on one side you have an adult that is depicted as point light in treating the child. And on the other side, you have the inverted animation and it's played backwards. Of course, the idea is to get into that girl's mind and can she actually recognize that template of a human being basically in treating her. And so
Johnny,
this is how the animation plays.
Look, it's Teddy. Do you want to play with Teddy? Teddy wants to play with you.
You got the idea. And so when this is now a two-year-old, typically developing two-year-old, looking at this animation, and you see that crosshair, it tells you exactly where the two-year-old is looking at. And immediately, that two-year-old is looking at the upright animation.
Time to eat some food. Ready? Here we go. Here comes the first bite.
Well, that's, of course, because typically, in most of the world, adults approach babies upright rather than inverted. So that's the template. So what about that little girl? When we showed nine animations for this little girl, she was entirely random. so she could not distinguish one from the other. And when we tested this with two other little girls, one a 15-month older and one a 9-month older, they showed the expected strong preferential response to the upright. But there was one animation that our little girl really got it right. And she showed this overwhelming preference to the upright, and this was the animation.
Patty cake, baker's man.
Well, there's something special about that animation. There is the clapping that is happening, and therefore our hypothesis, as Warren and I watched that video, we're so happy, and we're looking at, could it just be, that rather than processing those point-light animations as actually a person and treating her, she was basically seeing lights, and she was hearing sounds, and basically she was responding to a physical contingency rather than a social one, which is what happens when you clap. This is all the visual synchrony. If so, when we look at her data, as we're watching this in my office, where would she look at? She would look at the clapping. And that's exactly what she did, which again raised the hypothesis, okay, so this is happening to this little girl. What about a whole bunch of other two-year-olds? And what we found is that in typically developing two-year-olds and in non-autistic developmentally delayed two-year-olds, and then with the children of autism, the results are exactly the same. So in a way, they all showed the preferential response to the upright, and the two-year-olds with autism were random. And when we look at patty cake once again, the preference was there for the two-year-olds with autism, but of course, here the idea was that maybe they're not responding to people. They are responding to that physical contingency, the AVS, the audiovisual synchrony. And so we took a step back and forget that this point light animations are people. They are lights and sounds. And of course, behind that random behavior, what we see is this. Is that in those visual displays, there is audiovisual synchrony happening all the time, because when we talk and move, we are one unit of communication. So there is this kind of unexpected audiovisual synchrony happening all the time. We went on to quantify that, and this is a heat map. Every time you see a hot color, it basically a lot of audiovisual synchrony is happening. And what we saw in here is that the audiovisual synchrony is happening not only on the upright side, it's also happening on the inverted side, which basically means that we could test a hypothesis. And the hypothesis was, could it just be, that our children with autism are ignoring the social nature of the stimuli, and they are responding entirely to the audiovisual synchrony, the physical contingency. And so what we did is that we quantified the amount of audiovisual synchrony in one side relative to the other, in the upright, rather than relative to the inverted. And here are the results. And the results are that for the two-year-olds with autism, about 90% of the visual preferences as they're looking at those stimuli was actually guided by the amount of audiovisual synchrony. And not so for the two other groups who prefer to focus on the social nature of those stimuli. And we went on to conduct two additional experiments in a new cohort, and indeed, that hypothesis was strengthened in this. Now, why am I boring you to tears with point light displays? Because there is something very critical in that foundational mechanism of socialization. It's because when we're looking at people, there is biological motion everywhere. There is in our facial gestures, there is in our bodily gestures. And as we are being treated by a caregiver, if we are an infant, we process that person in front of us as a human being, right? And so when you see something like that...
Are you ready to wake up?
Well, babies come into this world, they fall in love with people's eyes. So the eyes are not only the window to people's souls, it's also the window to social neuroscience. So was that little girl doing that?
Hi, sweetie. Are you ready to wake up? Come on. Did you sleep well?
Well, not quite. She was spending a lot of time focusing on that mouth. Now, the mouth is, of course, the place on us that we have the most audiovisual synchrony, as our lip movements and our speech sounds are, of course, covariant, and they are synchronous. So here was our hypothesis. Could it be that she's basically looking at the mouth because she's guided by that drive to focus on physical rather than social contingency? I have to say that we never rehearsed this thing, so we thought that this would be a good place to have a beginning.
In our minds, this is a really radical hypothesis in terms of terms of thinking about. Are we on there now? I think they've just made the switch over. We're going to keep them on their toes as well as we decide when we want to switch back and forth. But in our minds, this was a radical hypothesis to think about the fact that that little girl could be watching a face but seeing physical contingencies. And that, in fact, her moment-by-moment fixations might be driven by the presence of physical contingencies at different locations present on the face. And so a research fellow within the lab set about quantifying audiovisual synchrony not only within those point light displays, but actually across the face of a caregiving conspecific.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you...
is lighting up at locations where there's increased audiovisual synchrony. And you see that happening at the mouth as she talks, much like we saw in the video from that little girl a moment ago. But you also see audiovisual synchrony happening around the eyes because our entire faces embody some of the ways in which we're moving and sending those signals. And yet the question for us was really, which of those factors might guide looking in typically developing two-year-olds and in two-year-olds with autism? And so when we look at the results, comparing the level of audiovisual synchrony in different regions of the face to how much time typically developing two-year-olds spend looking at those parts of the face, we find that those children are flat in terms of that relationship. But when we look at the same data for two-year-olds with autism, we see that as audiovisual synchrony increases in a particular region of the face, they're increasing their fixation on that location. In a series of follow-up studies collected and conducted with a very close colleague and collaborator, Dr. Gordon Ramsey, Dr. Ramsey set about creating a set of highly controlled stimuli that would allow us to manipulate physical contingencies in the presence of different social contexts so that we could carefully measure the effect that these contingencies might have on scanning under controlled circumstances. And so to give an example of what this actually looks like, here we have another caregiver actress entreating the child, and yet Dr. Ramsey introduced another stimulus on the other side of the screen.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are.
So you notice that that ring is moving in very particular ways, and what it's doing is that the size of the area within that ring is varying in exact relationship to the short-term audio amplitude of whatever it is that the actress is saying. So we've introduced audiovisual synchrony in a geometric figure that otherwise wouldn't have it and presented it alongside a caregiving conspecific who's otherwise trying to engage the onlooking child. And so research fellows in the lab analyzed these data, brought in toddlers to see how they would look, how they would pay attention to these kind of displays as they are presented. And when typically developing two-year-olds watch these displays, unsurprisingly, they continue to focus on the face of that caregiving actress. They're paying attention to her facial features despite the fact that that ring is moving back and forth in time to what they're saying. But when they show these same stimuli to two-year-olds with autism, what we find is that the introduction of that highly audiovisual synchronous moving ring is enough to remove any preferential looking for the caregiving conspecific. So if you think about the extent to which these kind of cues in the environment can steer visual attention in the mind of a developing child, and we come back to this little girl, the question for us is, how are those experiences shaping the development of her brain time and time again in everyday experience when the world around us is filled with physical contingencies that are irrelevant for a lot of the social meaning? We know from decades of neuroscience that the period in the first 3 years postnatal are the largest periods of dynamic brain growth. Brain size doubles within the first year alone. Synaptic density quadruples. Each one of those events builds upon those experiences that a child is having, either with social interaction or with some of those physical contingencies as we just noted. And as children are growing, the opportunities for social interaction and the demands of social interaction become increasingly rich. Just like a faculty meeting. As children grow within the space of just this 17-second video, you have dozens of different social cues. And as you watch those videos, moment by moment by moment, you differentially allocated your available visual resources to look at the right thing at the right moment in time in order to gather the most meaning about how those children are acting and reacting, how they're feeling, how they're thinking, what their joint learning experience will be from this. And so over the years, as we've tried to develop methods to capture and quantify children's response to this, we think about the ways in which, on a moment-by-moment basis, we have limited visual resources that need to be allocated to this on-screen social information. So if we take one moment from this video and think about the fact that the world is not flat, we have limited visual resources in terms of cortical magnification and the distribution of photoreceptors in the eye, and we think about the way that a group of typically developing two-year-olds would differentially allocate their attentional resources to this, we can actually build up a quantitative model of how they're allocating attention at each moment in time. And so this is a map that's built up for 44 typically developing two-year-olds based upon their eye tracking data. Each one of those points on our sort of topographic landscape is a point where one toddler is looking at that particular moment in time. And as we take this kind of bird's eye view down upon those data, we've color scaled in such a way that areas that receive the greatest proportion of visual resources for this group of toddlers are in hotter colors. And those areas that receive less resources are in cooler colors. And we can think about the action within this video unfolding on a moment by moment basis, such that at each moment in time, this differential landscape of salience is shifting in such a way that sometimes typically developing two-year-olds all focus on one of these hot spots of socialization. So something has happened within this video that has drawn the attention of all of these viewers to the same spot at the same moment in time. And this is a powerful force when we think about events in the general environment that are steering typical development. If we take another view on this same data, leave one of those maps flattened out, extend the other portion here so that that third axis is now time. We're mapping out the changing differential landscape of salience and how it is shaped over time in an interaction between what these toddlers are looking for and what the social cues are that are happening within the video. And we can actually core out the portion of this volume of data to identify these moments in time when, for typically developing two-year-olds, there's been an attentional funnel. There's been some change in which initially they've been looking at many different locations, and then to the right of the screen, they all focus on the same spot at the same moment in time. Setting that back within the space of the video that they were watching, we can begin to see how this attentional funnel really captures the moment-by-moment allocation of dynamic visual attention and the way that these children are selectively attending to and learning from their environment. The world is not flat. They pay attention to the things that matter most at particular instances in time, and those are the things that constitute incredible learning events throughout child development. We see one that ended just right there as these children follow a joint attention cue, and the cup in that toddler's hand becomes important because the on-screen toddler looked at that for the first time. And so as we collect these data, one of the things that was most remarkable to us is that these are typically developing two-year-olds. We're showing them about 5 minutes of video scenes of interaction, and we found that the majority of toddlers looked at the same locations at the same times approximately 80% of the time. I don't know how many of you have spent time with two-year-olds, but getting them to do anything with any consistency is not within our expectations. So what we found was that these naturally occurring social presses that presented some relevant information offered an opportunity for the objective quantification of allocation of social resources. And so in this case, our typically developing attentional funnel looks to the emotional expression. And these are scan paths for two-year-olds on the autism spectrum. Typically developing children are funneling in on the emotional expression on that little guy's face as he protests about the status of the door. Two-year-olds with autism are actually looking at the door handle itself on that wagon. Over the course of 5 minutes of video, we see not one or two, but many, many of these instances when the scanning patterns of two-year-olds with autism diverges from our expectations from typically developing individuals. And in fact, the frequency with which this happens is more than sixfold greater than we would expect by chance if we measure how often we might find these divergences in typically developing children by chance alone.
I need to project my voice. Can you hear me? Good. So let's stop for a second. 682 divergences within the context of 5 minutes of free viewing. I don't need to tell you that our children are not only diverging what they're looking at within our experiment. This is happening throughout their waking lives. And so if you think about 682 in 5 minutes, we're talking about thousands and thousands of opportunities for social learning that are there presented to them every day that they are missing. Now, you can imagine what is the accrual of that experience, and the fact that, you know, brains are kind of blind and deaf. In a way, brains are repositing experiences. We can present the same stimuli to children, but if they are processing differently, their brains, of course, are processing that differently. So we are talking about an accrual of divergences, not only of allocation of visual resources, but truly of learning. Now, how does that get instantiated on an everyday basis? Well, you just saw that video, and you see at the top our landscape of salience for toddlers with autism, and at the bottom, for typically developing toddlers, and at the bottom the ones with autism. So as you follow the unfolding of the social situation, you see how they are allocating their resources, and the fact that the two groups are basically paying attention to very different things indeed. Now, the good news is that that little story ends up with a good ending. Now, if you're really trying to think about the culmination of that experience and what these two groups of children took from that video, you see what happens at the top. There is a focus on the kids, which is basically the reconciliation, and at the bottom, the kids are spread all over the place. So what happens is these are the opportunities that we have to understand others, to understand people's feelings, communication patterns, intentions, and all of those things that happen in the mind that are invisible, but they determine people's behavior. So we really had to sort of capitalize on this level of quantification and create a measurement. You know, what Warren mentioned before, that 80% of time, the kids are looking at the same place at the same time. Well, those are truly enculturation forces. There is an entrainment that happens onto those hot spots of socialization. And so we derived this measure, a measure of relative entrainment, and you see here just one instance, and the little dots are individual children with autism. And as you summarize this data for all of those sort of opportunities or experimental presses, that five-minute experiment actually has tremendous clinical validity, because it can't predict the level of social disability contemporaneously measured, meaning at the age of two. But then if you go to time two, which is 1.5 years later, that correlation actually is much stronger. And the reason is that the measure that you just mentioned to you is really a measure of social learning. So it's stronger when it's predicting something in the future. In fact, that experiment predicts the ADOS scores at time two more strongly than the ADOS scores in time one predicts itself in time two. Well, we try to capitalize on this level of quantification. Can we actually use that for the purpose of segregating toddlers with autism? And so we could train the system to segregate groups of children with autism and their typical controls, and then we can have another sample to test this particular algorithm. And as you can see from these ROCs, that level of discrimination has been quite high, and so that particular procedure has been able to reach levels of sensitivity and specificity over 80%. Now, as a clinician, we want more. We don't want simply to segregate to groups of children. We want to be able to dive into dimensionality of children's profile, because that's what we need for the purpose of early intervention. So could we actually train our algorithms to also predict level of function, meaning the level of social disability as measured by the ADAS, or the level of nonverbal and verbal intelligence as measured by the Mullen? And indeed, what you see here, the regression lines, the gray ones are the training set, and the black ones are the testing ones. And that particular procedure achieves a level, a proxy, for both social disability and for both nonverbal and verbal intellectual ability at that age. You.
So... Ami began by starting to talk about that little girl. And as we develop these measures, the question, a key question for us and a key question for the field is, as we get better and better objective quantifiers of the social in social disability, a key challenge for the field is, how do we try to connect those measurements to the genetic bases of autism? So we know from other studies that autism is one of the most highly heritable of all neurodevelopmental conditions. And so a question for us is, can we begin to link those quantifications to the genetic bases? And we were fortunate, extremely fortunate in this effort, to collaborate and team up with an outstanding colleague at WashU, Dr. John Constantino. John's team, together with our team, over the past few years, has collected data from more than 338 toddlers, opening up a possibility to look at concordance and social visual engagement as a function of zygosity. So by collecting data in identical twins, in fraternal twins, as well as in unfamiliarly related comparison children, and a set of children with autism, we can begin to get some hold on whether or not these measures connect to underlying genetics. And I think one of the best ways to begin to get a sense of what these data look like, I'll remember one thing first. I'm going to show a little bit of an overview of these data. For the richer, more complete presentation, go see Dr. Stephanie Kennan-McGill's poster this afternoon. It is at 12. It is poster number 81. There will be additional details that we don't have the time to get to go through today. So that's a little plug for the extended version there. In order to give you a glimpse now of what those data look like and the phenomenon that we're measuring, we wanted to see what was the extent to which concordance and social visual engagement varies as a function of zygosity. So these are two 18-month-old dizygotic twins, fraternal twins, watching one of those caregiver videos. So you get a sense of the way in which they're looking at this video. They're, of course, watching it with audio. And now, as a comparison point, here are two monozygotic, identical 18-month twins watching the same video. So you see some remarkable levels of confluence, even at the stage of just looking at these video representations. For the purpose of trying to quantify how concordance varies, we went back to some of our measures to say, what is the extent to which individual children are looking at the eyes, and how does it relate across these different pair comparisons? So in the general population of children who are unrelated, our expectation is not particularly strong that the amount of time a child is spending looking at the eyes should directly predict the amount of time any other child is looking at the eyes. These are epidemiologically ascertained children from the general population. We've selected a time window in development at 21 months of age when there's huge variability in the amounts of eye and mouth looking, and that relates to some of the longitudinal data that we'll show in any moment. So for one particular point there, the extent to which child one's eyes predict child two's eyes can be highly variable. We take these children and in 10,000 bootstrap resamplings, randomly pair them to see the extent to which there's any concordance or relationship between children generally in the population. We find a correlation of zero. When we take these children and match them as precisely as we can upon sex and age at time of testing, and so we actually match these children at age of time of testing to within one day of one another, we see an uptick, although non-significant, in the intraclass correlation coefficient as a function of age and sex. When we look at fraternal twins, so children who share partial genotype matches, we see a further uptick in the level of concordance, so an ICC of about 0.36 for fraternal dizygotic twins. So then when we take a look finally at identical monozygotic twins, ICCs of 0.91 for the extent of eye looking. So 0.91 for the extent to which if twin one looks at the eyes that much, how likely is twin two to look at that in that case as well? So really what we're seeing in these data is extraordinarily strong evidence that individual variation in social visual engagement, in this case in eye looking in particular, is under strong genetic influence. We see modest effects of age and sex, and this complete spectrum of effects gives us a sense of the very high heritability in social visual engagement, on the order of broad sense heritability of about 0.9. So to us, this is extraordinarily exciting because it's the first time in the research that we've been doing when we go from highly quantitative measures of behavior and the way these children are looking at the world to a suggestion that this can be connected to underlying genetic influence. We're seeing that genetic influence in the way that individual children are paying attention to the world around them. As we follow these findings up, we find that that genetic influence persists across development. So we tested the children again 15 months later at 36 months. We see the same relationship at that point with even a trend towards a slightly wider disparity between monozygotic and dizygotic infant twins. We also find that genetic influence persists across stimulus type. So that column at the left that I'm showing there, those are the same data that I presented before. And as a consequence of the way that videos are presented, children watch slightly different sets. Presentation order is randomized, and so we had an opportunity to say, if we restricted our measurements only to instances when twins watch the exact same videos, would that increase the concordance for dizygotic twins? And we find that there's no change there at all. And we could look at the converse and say, when twins are actually not watching the same videos, when twin one is watching one video of a caregiver and twin two is watching a different caregiver video, what is the extent of concordance? And we find that for identical infant twins, it remains just as high, although it drops for the other two groups. And we could even go one step beyond that because we were presenting different kinds of social stimuli and say, what if one twin is watching one kind of movie, one kind of mutual gaze social interaction, and the other twin is watching a wholly different set, and we still see those very strong evidence of genetic influence guiding the extent to which there's concordance between those two twins. So in this case, twin one is watching the caregiver video stimuli that we showed before, and twin two is watching scenes of triadic peer interaction. And nonetheless, the extent to which one twin looks at the eyes is predictive of the extent to which the other one does. We also see genetic influence exerted on a moment-by-moment basis in the way that children, and I think you saw some of this within the past video that I showed. Again, these are 18-month-old dizygotic twins. And if you look in particular now in monozygotic twins at the extent to which these children are shifting their eyes at the same moments in time, shifting their eyes in the same directions, and ending up on the same content regions at each moment in time, you can begin to see, even in the videos, the extent to which genetic influence is playing a role in the way that these children are watching their everyday surroundings and learning from them. We can quantify these effects, and we can measure the extent to which the probability of twin two making an eye movement, how that changes as a function of whenever twin one makes an eye movement. So separate data collection sessions, but if we look at the timing of these things, whenever twin one makes an eye movement, twin two has an increase in probability of making that eye movement as well, if the twins are identical. If we restrict those measurements just to the moment of onset of an eye movement, to within plus or minus 16 milliseconds, identical twins are time-locking their saccadic eye movements in response to these stimuli. To us, this is a remarkable evidence of the extent to which genetics may play a role in these fundamental learning opportunities. We see similar data showing how monozygotic twins are more likely to shift their gaze in the same subsequent direction if they've been looking at a similar location to begin with. They're also more likely to fixate on the same eyes at the same moments in time. So rather than just an overall level of how much time they spend looking at the eyes, they're actually looking at the same eyes or the same mouths at the same particular moments in time. We had an opportunity with these data to also ask the question, for these measures that are most heritable in this epidemiologically ascertained population, how do these same markers compare to two-year-olds with autism? So these are from the general population sample, and this is from a first comparison cohort of 43 consecutive referrals to our diagnostic clinic watching these same videos. And what we find is that the same markers that are highly heritable in the general population are selectively diminished in toddlers with autism. We were so struck by how clear these results were and how clustered the kids with autism were that we ran an additional replication cohort of another any equals 45 who were set and seen within the last 6 months of 2016. And we find very similar degree of classification on the basis of these markers.
So as I was watching this work being done, and I was looking at results, and as Warren was discussing things with John Constantino, I had an existential crisis because I'm a deep believer in free will. And wait a minute, what is going on here? So we are looking at social visual engagement, the way that we both respond to the world and seek information in the world is highly heritable. And with high probability that children are going to deploy their attention at the same time, in the same direction, and onto the same semantic context in this world, well, I think the result of that is really the emergence of or the reemergence of this construct that children basically come into this world and they are creating their own environment. Basically, they are niche picking. They are basically creating an environment, and the way that they create that environment and interact with it is really under strict genetic influences. Of course, I'm a clinician. We are interested in early intervention. We are interested in changing developmental trajectories. But so, what happens with the other side of this equation? So you have the environment to engineer. And out of this reciprocal social interaction that happens between baby and caregiver, this is the way they were going to deliver our treatments. And despite this level of genetic determinism, the outcomes really come from that interaction. More about that momentarily. So we are sort of, in order to sort out my existential crisis, I needed to remember a great neuroscientist from New York, Joe Ledoux, mentioning something about the fact that the brains not only determine who we're going to be, but the brain also becomes who we are. And it becomes a repository of those lived experiences. And for that, we needed to go back. And, you know, babies are extraordinarily fragile. If you left them in the room, they would die. And so it just stands to reason that nature would sort out this survival issue in such a way that actually is going to move development forward. So they come into this world, and they are really searching for stimuli that sound like caregivers, that smell like caregivers, and that move like caregivers, and that look like caregivers, and that in fact interact and are active agents of entreating the child. And so it was critical for us to go back and see the unfolding of this mutually reinforcing choreography between baby and caregiver that becomes the platform for brain development. And so here's good old Warren with a lovely... typically developing 5-month-old, looking at a mom. You see, we are so proud that this is a non-invasive technique. So you see baby there, and baby's happy. Great. So as the baby is basically looking at that, at those stimuli, we are actually measuring what this baby is doing, what this baby is entraining to at many tens of times a second. And so here is a typically developing 5-month-old, and this is what that baby does when it's watching mom like. So the baby falls in love with the eyes and spends a great deal of time there because that's where the subjectivity is, that's where the intentionality is, that's where the baby is looking for that engagement. As we began to do this kind of work, we thought, wouldn't it be fun, if just like we have growth charts for physical height and for weight and for head circumference, if we could actually have growth charts for social visual engagement. Because our hypothesis is that maybe, you know, autism is not quite a disease entity. Autism may just be the disruption of normative processes that every baby has to do, has to go through. Those disruptions basically become markers of what happens eventually, which is the emergence of autism symptoms. And so in such of those growth charts of social engagement, we did studies in which we follow babies from the time they are born. We're crazy, so this is a densely sampled design. We see the babies at 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 9, and 12, and 15, 18, 24 months. And as we look at those growth charts of eye fixations, the way the babies are drawn to the eyes of others, you see that it goes up in the first 6 months of life, and then it goes down and recovers again. The bottom panel is basically the first derivative, is the change rate, which gives us a sense of what is the dynamic of that system, you know, when it's ramping up and when it's going down. This is for typically developing children. Children were ascertained as typical development. And for us, this is important because, as Warren was mentioned before, we are trying to map our assays onto genetic liabilities, into genetic burden, but we also want to map our assays onto critical milestones of development. Like you see here, these are some of the social interaction milestones that happens. And we can begin to time those eye-tracking assays as a reflection of those particular milestones that are being accomplished. We can do that also for the way the children all of a sudden discover that the mouths are important, because something that is coming out of mouths of people is kind of important. It's kind of called speech and language and so forth. And as we look at how mouth ramps up in the first 24 months of life, we can actually map those grades of increase on the basis of very specific speech milestones, from the time that they are making sounds that are speech-like through babbling, through canonical speech, which is when the babbling becomes more speech-like, all the way to the emergence of first words. And so our assays begin to become those reflections of all of those important milestones that are happening in the first 24 months of life. And if we do have now those typical benchmarks, typical development benchmarks, now we can compare this data to what happens if children who are at risk for autism.
So in comparison, we need to understand the developmental unfolding of autism, how those events transpire over time. And so using infant sibling study design, we're enrolling the younger siblings of children who have already been diagnosed and following them, as Amin described, from birth out through 36 months of age. And so these are results, again, for another five-month-old, but this time for a five-month-old who was later diagnosed with autism. And so what you see, in contrast to what Amin was describing as that other child looking at the eyes as a window to the soul, this child is spending a lot of time looking at the movements, looking at the moving mouth, looking at some of the hand gestures that happen on the side there. So our first set of results we published in 2013. And what we found was that attention to the eyes was present initially, but was in steady decline between 2 and 24 months of age. And in many respects, this was somewhat surprising to us. We expected that eye looking levels might be more diminished at the outset. We're going to come back to the importance of why that may be. But what we found instead was that levels of eye looking were initially present at levels that were actually a little bit elevated above the typically developing range, but were continuously declining between 2 and 24 months of life. This was the first set of children that we published in 2013. In follow-up studies, we just have another cohort that is aged up into the time when we can begin to look at their results and see the extent to which these children are following similar pathways. These analyses spearheaded by another fellow within the lab, Lindsay Olson. And what we find with our second cohort of children who've now aged up to the time of final confirmatory diagnosis is that we're again seeing the same pattern of initial attention in the eyes present but steadily declining between 2 and 24 months of life. You see that most clearly in the bottom panel there that again shows the rate of change in eye looking. To go back to this growth chart idea, you know, we're not only measuring typical development and the way that that meshes in, but now we're actually gaining an insight into a way in which multiple mechanisms may be disrupted if a child's social visual engagement is in some way atypical and becoming progressively so over time. And in these data, what we're really looking at is the disruption of early emerging, highly conserved mechanisms of social adaptive action. And we now have greater insight into understanding the extent to which these are truly highly conserved mechanisms of social adaptation. adaptive action because we've been measuring them directly in non-human primate species to see the extent to which in non-human primates for whom sociality is a key aspect of brain development and social hierarchies are a key aspect of their lived, learned environment, we can see similar patterns that would open up for us opportunities for model systems research in autism, both to understand typical parameters in ways that are challenging with human infants, but also to think about some of the opportunities afforded by model systems research. So with incredible collaborators at Yerkes National Primate Research Center, Jocelyn Bachevalier and Mar Sanchez, together with Longxuan Li at the Marcus Autism Center, we built these little infant monkeys, an infant monkey IMAX movie theater, complete with eye tracking, so that these monkeys could come into the lab and every week, between birth and 22 weeks of old, they could look not at human caregivers, but at monkey caregivers and at other monkeys at play, so we could measure the way in which monkeys are paying attention to their surrounding social landscape. And in infant rhesus, when we think about comparative cross-species lifespan, about 4 weeks in human development is about 1 week in rhesus macaque development. And so here are our data again for typically developing human infants between 2 and 24 months of life. We've now completed data collection on 33 rhesus macaque monkeys between the ages of 1 and 22 weeks. And what we found is remarkable cross-species homology. Notably, that homology is really captured in the rate of change of looking, in the way in which eye looking changes as a function of differing social adaptive value as the constraints on development change. As monkeys grow and develop and learn to look for new relevant social cues in the environment, they shift their looking patterns. To us, this is a remarkable degree of homology that opens up a series of opportunities in order to assay the neurobiological bases of social visual engagement. So the implications, both of that work and of the related things that we've been talking about for brain behavior development, I want to highlight some of the resources that are coming available right now because it's an exciting age in developmental and behavioral neuroscience and neuroscience as a whole, where we have more and more resources to begin to connect behavioral measures like these to underlying neurobiology. So we know that some of these time points, as we highlighted in the past slides, are places where there are clear differences. I've highlighted these also to note the fact that it's not that there aren't differences happening in that middle time point, but these measures and cross-sectional study designs can have major pitfalls if you choose the wrong time point at which we're collecting those measures. But the resources that we can begin to compare to are exciting now in order to contextualize what's happening in the brain at the same time that these developmental milestones or disruptions to developmental social norms are ongoing. So if we think about a resource like BrainSpan, spearheaded by Anand Sestan's group, published by Kang et al. In Nature, more than 17,000 genes, the expression of which was mapped from postnatal week 4 to late adulthood. And so in this plot here, we've downloaded some of these data from publicly available databases, and we've focused in particular on genes that are associated with canonical neurodevelopmental processes throughout the whole lifespan, but in order to be able to zoom in on the changes that are happening within this period of particular interest to us. Highlighted for 14 different brain regions here, when we look at the changes that we're able to measure and the differences already present between 2 and 6 months of life, what we see is that coinciding in terms of gene expression changes in brain, we're capturing the tail end of postnatal gene expression associated with neurogenesis, the beginning of an uptick in gene expression associated with synaptogenesis, a postnatal wave of dendrite development, and the beginnings of extensive myelination changes. Those changes between 2 and 6 months that we see behaviorally also precede a huge wave of gene expression activity associated with synaptogenesis, dendrite development, and ongoing myelination that then become before a second wave of behavioral differences manifest at 18 and 24 months of life. In our minds, this really highlights this critical window of directing more research towards those first 6 months of life, and in particular, to the transitions that happen in typical development at around 2 months of age, because it's an extraordinarily dynamic time when we see the emergence of very discrete skills in social reciprocity in typical infant development.
I'd rather listen to you than talk. But as we showed you those curves before, there was something that we observed that kind of really caught our imagination. As we look at those growth curves for the infants who were later diagnosed with autism relative to infants who were later ascertained as typical, what we realized is that of something very, very unusual. And what you see here is a significant difference between the blue and the red. In fact, the red being the children who ended up with autism, they really start at that growth chart at a higher level than the typical babies. And that sort of goes back to, again, another crisis, because, since the 80s and 90s, we've been sort of conjecturing that really critical mechanism of socialization, which is fixation to the eyes, that the children with autism were born without it. And if so, then you would see very low levels of eye fixation, and it would be flat. But that's not what we got. So we're wrong. Sorry. And so we had to focus really what happened early on in development. And this is what we saw. We conjectured the possibility that basically we're not talking about one curve. We're actually talking about two curves. And in fact, the piece that we're missing, because we could not calibrate children under the age of 2 months, it's because early on in development, as every neuropediatrician would be able to tell you, those babies simply do not have volitional control over their eye movements. And so we start sort of looking at this really critical transition that happens in the first weeks of life of the babies. Babies come into this world and they have a whole bunch of reflexes, and some of them are actually socialization reflexes. And so they are experience expectant. They are basically reflexively oriented to things that are people. And the mechanisms underlying those are really really subcortical. In a way, they are deploying those ancient brain structures, and those are in control, those reflexive movements. And then what you see is that around the age of sort of 4 to 12 weeks, you have the emergence of volitional movements, volitional behavior that now are experience dependent. Now those babies are actually reacting to others, and that's the beginning of that mutually reinforcing choreography called social development. And those things now are under control of cortical structures. So as we see the maturation of those connections between subcortical to cortical structures, we are basically seeing something that is of great importance, and that we should have known that. It's that this transition that happens in reflex-like predispositions to orient to faces to volitional, indeed, search for the faces of others. We see that babies, when they come into this world, they are smiling even when they are asleep, meaning that their smiling is really also reflexive, and that is a transition to, in fact, the emergence of social smiling, when the presence of the caregiver is, in fact, something that not only contributes to, but entrains in this, in those cycles of contingency over development. And there's a whole bunch of other transitions that are happening there, and the former being subcortically guided and the latter being cortically guided. And so this was the model. We see that in regards to eye looking, the reflex-like eye movement going down and voluntary going up. And we see that in the decline of endogenous smiling and on the climb up of social smiling. And we see also in terms of maturation of those brain structures, as those behaviors are unfolding, we see the emergence of this of visual behavior coming under control of cortical structures that eventually will constitute social brain networks. Now, if we go back to those growth charts, what we saw is that basically the children with autism were still on the first curve. They are still declining from that initial high reflex-like eye fixation, and it was not coming up. It was not being picked up by this second experience-dependent, cortically guided structure. Now, that's for us is a very exciting hypothesis, because it puts a window around the time of 2 to maybe 12 weeks, and gives us a sense that we're able to quantify the behavior from 0 to then. And now we need to look into brain structures. And in fact, our colleagues, Sarah Schultz and Lon Chuan, has been doing that very intensively through those longitudinal protocols in which babies are seen three times before they turn 6 months. And through resting state connectivity studies, and particularly through tractography, through DTI studies, we can begin to basically map those behaviors that I just showed you onto the maturation of that connectivity, the tracts that are now bringing together those structures and bringing this initial reflexes under volitional cortically guided control. So we told you a lot of things, but we never told you about our title, right? The title of Endophenotypes. We feel, let me just check. Okay, not bad. In terms of endophenotypes, why endophenotypes are important? Because people like Matt and then Gashwin and Stefan, who is here, all of the geneticists, have really advancing molecular genetics at such a speed, but we haven't been able to capitalize on those advances to really cross the chasm that currently exists between the genetic basis of autism and the behaviors that we see as they emerge as symptoms. And so those endophenotypes provide us that level of quantification that maybe, just maybe, we can go from gene to brain to behavior. So what are the criteria for those things to be there for us to use? They need to be quantitative. They need to be specific. In terms of segregating the populations, they need to be highly heritable. They need to be early emerging because autism is an early onset condition. It needs to be highly conserved because the mechanisms of socialization, as Warren was mentioning, are the things that determine our brains the most among primates. It needs to basically parallel the unfolding of the symptoms, and it needs to be individualized. So in that sense, we feel that, hey, things are good. Now, we are a clinical center, so we need to translate that developmental social neuroscience into something that is going to be of benefit to the community. So those kinds of methodologies, particularly the level of quantification of social function, the ability to segregate whole populations, our goal is ultimately to deploy those in the community and to create this high-throughput, community-viable tools that can basically advance our goals of improving universal screening and early detection and having quantified ways of diagnosing children but also proxying measures of development so that we can create treatments. And those treatments are really critical. As I'm sort of, we started today, we have seen in our own center that this early treatment, our ability to engineer that engagement, can change developmental trajectories with truly life time consequences. I came into this field a few years ago, like you did, and my sense is that those the greatest burdens of autism, the intellectual disability, the language disability, and the severe behavior challenges that our kids have, were absolutely inevitable. It's the brain, isn't it? But that isn't so. It's been a failure of imagination to imagine the 9-month-olds and 12-month-olds are like the kids that we see much later on. And so the possibility here for us to significantly attenuate these burdens is great. And what about the public health opportunities that we have? Well, unfortunately, we don't have many clinician experts in the world out there. And the vast majority of our kids don't have access to big academic centers. So we need to support that system, and we can elevate that system with a little bit of science. And it's also this notion that we're looking at autism as not necessarily as inevitability. We're looking at autism as a style of being in this world. These are uniquely human individuals who are there. They are learning about the world differently. And were we able to support them, we would be able to ensure that every child, regardless of the vulnerabilities that they bring into this world, will fulfill their promise. So that was the goal of this presentation, is to sort of break the notion, because there's a new generation of really brilliant scientists in this audience, and we believe that creating the opportunity for every child to thrive has become a bioethical imperative. Once you've seen neuroplasticity in front of you and the malleability of this condition, our next goal needs to be to ensure that every child has access to it. We have a lot of people to thank. We have the National Institutes of Mental Health and all of the other foundations that have supported. Most importantly, we have the children and families and our wonderful colleagues, many of them are here, our clinician colleagues and our students and our all of the folks that we have the privilege to work with for the past many years. Our fellows, many of them are here. We got you to San Francisco. Thank you for your posters and for your oral presentations. It was terrific. Let me thank Matt State and Susan Buchheimer for the privilege of speaking to you this morning. Thank you.